I should be thanking everyone for the opportunity, because I am always loving the opportunity to prepare for a sermon. It's something you just kind of, you know, there's a little bit of pressure. You've actually got to prepare something, but it's just the fact that you get that opportunity to really sit down and knuckle into the Word of God. I'm always incredibly blessed coming out of that, so thank you. Or some of you might recall, at the very beginning of the year, we started off on a series on King David, and we've since done a series on the book of Ephesians, which has been fantastic. But as we get towards the end of the year, we've got another big one coming. But before we do that, we've got to just have a couple of interim sermons in between, which are really just a couple of concepts to help, I guess, prepare us for that next series. And today I wanted to actually hark back to a little bit of that King David series that we did, because there's a character in there, Jonathan, who I absolutely love. I was telling Rocio this morning, as a boy in church, maybe 7 or 8 years old, as like we've got now, we've got all the children in here. I used to do the same during school holidays. You couldn't go out to the Sunday school, so we'd have to stay in church and listen to this incredibly boring sermon. So my parents gave us an ultimatum, or an option. We could either listen to the sermon or we could read the Bible. Oh, okay, I'll read the Bible. Okay, so what did I used to do? Well, I had a little Good News Bible at that age, so I used to pick out 1 Samuel every time, and I read and reread and reread the story of David and Jonathan, funny enough. So I have a bit of affinity for the passage, just because I do love the characters presented here. And so, children, if you get really bored of me talking here, just pull out 1 Samuel and have a good old read for yourselves, because you'll get a lot out of it just from that. Another little tidbit just before we get started, because the story of Jonathan and David is about friendship. And when I was in the early days of, before I was dating Rocio, when we were kind of friend-zoned or whatever, there was a particular quality in her that I found incredibly attractive. I guess a character attribute that really told me a lot about what she was as a person. That's turned out to hold true. So I'm going to give you that as a little tidbit. I'll be telling you some way in, but for some of you might go, oh, what does Sean find, you know, as a good character trait in a woman? Well, I'll tell you soon enough, so bear that in mind. So a little setting of the scene, where we kick off, before we get into Jonathan, let's just give a little bit of background. Some of you remember the great stories of Israel, how they came out of Egypt. Some of you might have seen the movie The Prince of Egypt and Moses and the sea, how God opened up the sea so the Israelites could walk through. And they ultimately, after a lot of problematic years, ended up in the Promised Land. And for some time, according to the biblical record, probably about 400 years, they were ruled by a bunch of what are called judges. So they had the priesthood, one of the tribes, of the Levites, would act as kind of a quasi-government in some respect, although primarily only for spiritual matters. And judges came and essentially brought the people back to God, as they would tend to fall away regularly, and there was this repeating cycle. But eventually, in the book of Samuel, the prophet Samuel is getting old, and the people come to him and say, look, you're getting old, you're going to die, and we're just worried this cycle of, you know, we keep falling away and we need these great judges or prophets to come and help us. So we're sick of this. Can you give us a king? Because all the nations around us have kings and they're all doing pretty well, so we want a king. Now, this actually grieved God a lot, because that was not his design. And in giving them a king, he said, look, nothing's going to change. You're still going to have this cycle, because the problem is you, not the fact that you don't have a king. And so whether or not you have a king makes no difference, but because you've requested it, I'm going to give it to you. So he gave him a king with all these attendant warnings of what problems. So even when it was going to be good, now you're going to have these kings which are going to make life a little rough for those under them. But anyway, they said they wanted a king, and Samuel gave them. He appointed this young man called Saul out of obscurity. He was a relatively... he was of low position overall. However, he was in his person, he was a very tall fella and imposing. So in some respects, he had a bit of a charisma about him, potentially. When they appointed him king, he was so scared, he ran away and hid in some tents, as we know. So he wasn't, when people said, oh, who's this king? They couldn't actually find the guy. He didn't even want to stand up in front of everyone. So it was a little bit of an interesting scenario. But shortly after, there was this little town of Jabesh, and I'll probably pronounce that wrong, so please correct me after the service, not now. But this little town of Jabesh, and everyone's going, oh, what on earth is this point of having this king? You know, he doesn't even want to stand up in front of the people. He wandered off back to his family farm after he was anointed king. So what good of it? What good is it? But in the little town of Jabesh, there the Ammonites. So there were a lot of kind of surrounding countries around Israel that were very hostile. One of them was the Ammonites. They went to this little town and basically said, no, we're going to come and cut out the right eye of every man in the town, which of course freaked him out. And they're like, he's going to save us. And Saul actually had a flash of brilliance. He went around, well, he cut up an ox, distributed it all over the land, and said, every man who doesn't come join me in a fight is going to have his ox slaughtered like this. So a whole bunch of people who didn't want their ox slaughtered went and joined him. And funny enough, they actually did this little trickery on the Ammonites and ultimately ambushed them as they were around the town and had this great victory. And after that, everyone's mood changed. Like, we've got a king. Look what he just did. He just literally solved this problem for the people who lived at Jabesh. And within that experience, we actually see that Saul was anointed. 1 Samuel 11 says, when Saul heard the words of the people of Jabesh, the problem that they had, he said, the Spirit of God came powerfully upon him and he burned with anger. So God was using him at this very early stage. So that's all well. He really establishes his kingdom at that point. People acknowledge this king Saul as a king. And this is when we're first introduced to Jonathan then. And we're going to be reading a fair bit of the Bible, so let's actually rip that out. You want to get the book of 1 Samuel open. We'll be starting around chapter 13. So get it out. I like it, a good old-fashioned read-along, so we'll be doing plenty of reading today. And we'll start in chapter 13, verse 3, where we see the first little bit of Jonathan. It just says, and Jonathan attacked the garrison of the Philistines that was in Geba. And the Philistines heard of it. So this is interesting. So Jonathan, the first mention we've got on him, clearly some kind of warrior. He was, the verses before told us, he'd been put in charge of a third of the core army. There were about 3,000 men in the core army that King Saul brought together. 1,000 of them were under Jonathan. They went and smote the garrison of the Philistines. Okay, that's cool. But the Philistines were a powerful people group, and by doing this slaughter, he aroused them in some catastrophic way. And very shortly thereafter, it says that Israel had become an abomination, or others say a great smell to the Philistines. They were so cheesed off that they'd smoked this garrison. They brought together a massive army. So we're thinking, you know, King Saul's got a core army of about 3,000. These guys brought out 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and innumerable infantry. So this was a major problem. Little King Saul, he's had this little victory over the Ammonites, has suddenly bitten off way more than he can chew. His son's gone out, taken this Philistine garrison, and whoa, what a response. Okay, this is like us trying to fight China. Yeah, would not go well. So fair enough, the Israelites were scared. Samuel was nowhere to be seen. So what does King Saul do? Well, he's just worried because even the small group of men he's got are fleeing by the day. So he actually goes ahead and offers a burnt offering to God to try and keep people happy. I don't want to spend a lot of time on King Saul, but essentially that was definitely not the right thing to do. He was supposed to wait for Samuel to do it because it was the responsibility of the priest to do so. So God judges Saul in that moment. But notwithstanding all that's happening with Saul, Jonathan's still within this camp. He's quite a loyal fella, and we'll see that over time. And he's sitting in this, I think it's Geba, where they were camped. The Philistines have got so many extra men. They're sending out companies left, right and centre. They've got companies raiding to the north, south, east. So there's people going everywhere. But he sneaks off with his armour bearer. To make matters worse, none of the Israelites had any weapons. The Philistines had actually taken all the blacksmiths. So essentially, if you wanted to get your implements turned into weapons, you had to go to the Philistines. And of course, the Philistines wouldn't turn any Israelite implements into weapons. So other than Jonathan and Saul, it looks like no one had a weapon in all of Israel. But Jonathan takes his armor bearer and sneaks off, and you know what he does? And we'll have a little look here, actually. You'll see that. So that there is kind of a valley. So you had the Philistines in this place called Michmash, I don't know, sorry again. And on the other side, Geba with the Israelites. And in between are these kind of really rugged passes and valleys. So Jonathan sneaks through some of these. And he's at the bottom of one of them, and he can actually see the Philistine garrison. And so he didn't just go for one of the raiding parties. He's actually gone to the main garrison. So this is where the lion's share of the army is sitting. And we'll read from verse 14, verse 6. Let's see this. We'll take it up there. So chapter 14, verse 6 of 1 Samuel. So then Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armour, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. he was taking a few to the extreme there, but there you go, two men. So his armor bearer said to him, do all that is in your heart, go there. Here I am with you according to your heart. So Jonathan said, very well, let us go over to these men and we will show ourselves to them. If they say thus to us, wait until we come to you, then we will stand in our place and not go up to them. But if they say thus, come up to us, then we will go up, for the Lord has delivered them into our hand, and this will be a sign to us. So he's done a classic, you know, put two options out there and ask God to indicate his will through an example. As Thomas said to me the other day, he kind of made the most obvious option, that they would tease them into coming up, being the one that would mean that they were going to get the victory. So he was really goading the situation on, so it seemed. So they do. We'll keep on going. This is a great story. So in verse 11, it says, so both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes where they have hidden. They were obviously not too impressed with their foe, who were literally hiding in the hills of this area. So verse 12, then the men of the garrison called to Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, come up to us and we will show you something. Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me, for the Lord has delivered them into the hand of Israel. So there is some mighty confidence there in what God's going to do. Two against a multitude. So verse 13, and Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him. So you can see why. That's literally how they were getting up over this kind of terrain. And Jonathan climbed up on his hands and knees with his armor bearer after him, and they fell before Jonathan. And his armor bearer... Oh, sorry. And as he came after him, his armor bearer killed them. That first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor bearer made was about 20 men within about half an acre of land. So they're obviously, it's not battle array here. They just got a couple of, you know, rebellious guys on the edge of a garrison, or insolent guys, I should say, who've called them up, and they literally just start knocking him down. 20 men is not a bad effort straight off the bat. But then what happens, verse 15, and there was trembling in the camp in the field and among all the people. The garrison and the raiders also trembled, and the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. Now the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and there was the multitude melting away, and they went here and there. So Saul's back in the camp, and we skipped a bit there, but they didn't even know where Jonathan had got up to. For a while they didn't even know he'd disappeared and wandered off. And now they're looking out and they're just seeing this massive Philistine multitude melting away. And Saul said to the people who were with him, now call the roll and see who has gone from us. And when they had called the roll, surprisingly, Jonathan and his armor-bearer were not there. And Saul said to Ahijah, bring the Ark of God here. For at that time, the Ark of God was with the children of Israel. Now it happened while Saul talked to the priests that the noise which was in the camp of the Philistines continued to increase. So Saul said to the priest, withdraw your hand. And Saul and all the people who were with him assembled, and they went to the battle, and indeed every man's sword was against his neighbour, and there was very great confusion. So by this point, still the Israelites have actually done nothing other than maybe killing about 20 men through the hand of Jonathan and his armour-bearer, and yet this it totally destroyed the morale and created mass confusion amongst the Philistines. So we read from verse 21, moreover, the Hebrews who were with the Philistines before that time, who went up with them into the camp from the surrounding country, they also joined the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. What a time to make an appearance, eh? Right when you're winning the battle. So anyway, they come out, and we'll end it there, but basically they turn and rout the Philistines. This is an absolutely incredible victory, and it's got to really... parallel with some of the greatest in the Bible, although we don't read it as often, which I'm not really sure why. It's an amazing story. But it just really tells you a little bit. This is really our first glimpse of Jonathan, and it tells you a lot about him, doesn't it? You know, that he was a mighty warrior, and that he was obviously filled with the Spirit to be able to kind of have God go with him in these incredible events. And through this event, he became an incredibly popular man in Israel as well. So you may have King Saul, who was definitely cemented by king at this time. After this event, King Saul is King Saul. There's no question that we now have a ruler in this country. But who's the man who's made him that? It's Jonathan. And people well know it. So Prince Jonathan is one of the, I guess, greatest men in Israel at this time. He is the eldest son of King Saul. He's the heir to the throne. And he has a reputation from this event that precedes him. So it's good to get a bit of an understanding of the type of man this was, because what happens afterwards is really going to tell us about his character as well, because in every sense, he is worthy to be the next king of Israel, in every sense. before God even. You know, there's no hint anywhere that he ever does anything wrong before God. So then we come to 1 Samuel chapter 18. So we skip a few chapters, and in that few chapters is where David comes onto the scene. And I won't recount that story, but I think most of us know David and Goliath, where he slays the giant and similarly has a great victory on behalf of Israel, which is clearly through the hands of this one man. And after this event, David kills Goliath. They have a big rout again. He comes back, and all the palace are starting to, you know, basically talk with him. He's brought into the palace, and Jonathan meets him for the first time in chapter 18. So let's just read that. If you flip through to chapter 18, verse 1. And when he had finished speaking to Saul, it says, "The soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." So it's a major thing. He's seen something in David that I would arguably say he's seen in himself. You know, he's got that same spirit. They are both mighty warriors in their own right. They've both been used by the Spirit of God in a great way. And Jonathan loved David. And so in verse 3, he makes a covenant with him. He says, "Then Jonathan and David made a covenant because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan took off the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, even to his sword and his bow and his belt." So we have this cementing of a friendship really early on. And there's an interesting word in there. You might see the word covenant and go, what on earth is that? The closest thing we've got at the moment is it's basically the same kind of idea in marriage. We have an agreement at the beginning. We have vows that we give to each other. These are a form of covenant, essentially agreement. So this was a friendship that they actually formalised. They actually committed certain things and they covenanted to each other. It's essentially a series of promises, almost a contractual thing, but it doesn't have that kind of same kind of spirit. It's essentially a very strong agreement. So they covenant with each other. And this covenant is what's going to define Jonathan from hereafter. So let's have a little look in. By chapter 19, things start to get a little interesting. King Saul is jealous of David because David, after the event with Goliath, and he had some other military successes after that, the people were really warming to David. And King Saul knew, because of what the prophet Samuel told him, that his kingdom was going to be given to another. He was on the eye out for the threat, and he wanted to kill them. So he starts pursuing David. David's done nothing wrong, but he's after and out to kill David. So this we know from the previous series, but Jonathan actually has some pivotal roles in how this all plays out. So we look at chapter 19, the first time this has really happened, where Saul's out to get David. In chapter 19, verse 1, it says, "Now Saul spoke to Jonathan his son and to all his servants that they should kill David. But Jonathan, Saul's son, delighted greatly in David," which we know of. "So Jonathan told David, saying, 'My father Saul seeks to kill you. Therefore, please be on your guard until morning and stay in a secret place and hide. And I'll go out and stand beside my father in the field where you are, and I will speak with my father about you. Then what I observe, I will tell you.'" Now, I won't read the whole thing there, but essentially does go up to Saul, and he convinces Saul, "What has David done? He's one of your greatest and most loyal servants. What has he ever done to you?" And Saul agrees with him, and essentially the whole thing's off. Now, we know the story. Saul will keep coming back to this same line of argument and keep on killing. But for the very first time, Jonathan actually stayed his hand. And so he actually had some success in helping David. And you could see there, he was the one who went out of his way to warn him. Now, it's worth saying at this stage, we'll go to the next story, because there's a point I want to make about Jonathan and his relationship with Saul, which can kind of give us some insight to that. So we know chapter 19 was the first time Saul gets to the point where he wants to kill David. Chapter 20 now, and he's at it again. All right, he wants to kill David. And this time David's got the knowledge without Jonathan, and he's going up to him. So chapter 20, verse 1, "David fled from Naloth and Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, 'What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?'" So verse 2, "So Jonathan said to him, 'By no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so.'" That verse there is a little insightful, because it does show us that Jonathan had a great relationship with Saul, as a general rule. You know, they were so close enough that Saul would not do anything, he says, without telling Jonathan. And it's not surprising, given how pivotal Jonathan was in the reputation towards the people, how pivotal he had been in those early battles. And he was loyal to Saul. He actually had a good relationship with him individually. And he's willing to put that in jeopardy for the sake of David when he sees it's wronged. And so we'll see that. So in verse 3, it says, "And David took an oath again and said, 'Your father certainly knows that I've found favour in your eyes.' And he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.'" So Saul cared about Jonathan as well, because Jonathan was very important to him. "But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death." And so this chapter here, and I'm wondering whether I'll read all of it, because time can easily get away. What we might do is just summarise what happens here, but it is kind of the pivotal moment of Jonathan and David. This is where Jonathan's going to take the time to and put himself in the position of essentially fleshing out what King Saul really thinks of David. Now, in this process, when David's saying, "Look, can you do this for me? I'm going to go hide. Can you..." Basically, he details an arrangement where he's not going to be there and he's going to get King Saul so revved up that eventually he'll have to start asking people, "Where's David? I want to kill him." And Jonathan's going to be there so he can basically gauge what King Saul's true sentiment is. But knowing the perilousness of all this, David and Jonathan keep reaffirming their covenant between each other. Let's just look at verse 14 quickly. So chapter 20, verse 14. "And you shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." This is Jonathan asking David to covenant with him. "And so Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying that the Lord required at the hand of David's enemies. And Jonathan again calls David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul." And so with that covenant in place, they hatch out this plan. And ultimately, we get to a point where King Saul himself throws a spear at Jonathan, because Jonathan, again, is defending David in the heat of the moment when King Saul said, "No, I want to kill him." And he says some important things there. Let's look at verse 30. "And Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said to him, 'You son of a perverse, rebellious woman, do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now therefore send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die.' And Jonathan answered Saul his father and said to him, 'Why should he be killed? What has he done?' Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David." He was going to kill the messenger. And you could see the fracture there. Saul has had it that Jonathan is supporting this great nemesis of him, David, even though David's done no wrong. And Saul's made it very plain. And this is the thing, though. Jonathan knew this. He knew that his kingdom was not going to be established while David's as well. He had actually accepted that. In terms of his friendship and his attitude towards God, even though he was rightfully deserving of that place, he said, "No, I'm going to be second to David because that's what God wants." So Jonathan has found out that indeed Saul wants to kill David. So at the very end of this chapter 20, he meets up with David again, tells him, "Yes, indeed the case, you're going to have to go on the run." It's a great sad time. They know they're not going to see each other for a long time. And so they weep and embrace and kiss and send each other off. And that's pretty much the end of it, because that is a farewell. They're not really going to see each other again. There is a brief moment in chapter 23, but still an important one, so we'll look at that. So after this event, David's on the run for many years, and King Saul is attempting to find him out and sends various parties out to try and find him. And during this time, Jonathan actually manages to find David and encourages him. So let's just look at that. 1 Samuel chapter 23, verse 15. He says, "So David saw that Saul had come out to seek his life, and David was in the wilderness of Ziph in a forest. Then Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David in the woods and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, 'Do not fear, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find you. You shall be king over Israel, and I shall be next to you. Even my father Saul knows that.'" So the two of them made a covenant before the Lord, and David stayed in the woods and Jonathan went to his own house. So this is the last recorded event where they actually saw each other, but what an encouragement there. Jonathan's come out to David in his darkest place and told him, indeed, God is going to be faithful to his promise to you. Saul's not going to find you, no matter how it looks. And see again how he de-elevates himself. He has put himself under David, even though he had every right in himself to be that man. He said, no, I'm going to be second to you, David. And he wasn't shy in telling everyone about it as well. He said, even King Saul knows this. Everyone knew that Jonathan had that attitude about him, that he was happy to be second to David. So the end of Jonathan is very sad and touching. He was faithful to his father, and on this mountain, Mount Gilboa, the Israelites have a great defeat against the Philistines. God is not with King Saul at this point. We know that finally the time has come where King David is going to become king, but there is the end of a dynasty, King Saul and Jonathan, and they're both killed. And so we get to... So then in the next chapter, we see a really touching tribute by King David as he learns of his friend's death. And it's just beautiful. If we look at... I won't read it now again because I'm conscious of time's getting away, but 2 Samuel chapter 1, you just look from verse 19 onwards how he remembers Jonathan and King Saul as well and their grandeur, because this was the end of a great dynasty at the time, and God had anointed them for a time. And there Jonathan was, you know, alongside his father in death, and they weren't separated. Now, at the very end here, Jonathan is obviously gone, but it's not the end of the story. David and Jonathan had made many covenants to each other. And we've got to remember, straight after King Saul and Jonathan died, there was still this little bit of friction. King David didn't just waltz in as king of Israel. In fact, there was a remaining son of Saul called Ishbosheth, who continued to retain a large part of Israel under his kingdom, and they were essentially a civil war between them. So it wasn't a given thing that David would just go and grab any descendant of Saul and welcome into his house, because he was actually at war for quite some time with the last remnants of Saul's house. Because there were plenty who believed that the house of King Saul would continue on. Ultimately, Ishbosheth died, but David actually comes to a point, and we read that in chapter 9 of 2 Samuel, we'll just touch on that briefly, where he says, "Now David said, is there still anyone who is left of the house of Saul?" This is after, you know, that he had taken control of the whole kingdom by this point. He's going, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul? And say, oh, so we can kill him? No, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. And this is a beautiful thing. And so there was a servant of the house of Saul whose name was Ziba, and he told him about this young fellow called Mephibosheth. Again, I'll probably mispronounce that badly, but that'll do. But Mephibosheth was lame, and David essentially brings him in to the palace. He gives him all the remaining property of King Saul. He has his servants attend to him, and he lets him eat at his table from hereafter as a kindness to Jonathan. And so David remembered that, and again, even to the potential threat, I mean, yes, you could argue he wasn't much of a threat, but nonetheless, he was still very consciously making that decision, and he was conscious of doing it very publicly as well, that he would make this son of the house of Saul, of Jonathan, so he was actually a son of Jonathan himself, prominent in the kingdom as a sign of his friendship to him. So thus is the story of Jonathan and David, and behoove me just to spend a brief time making a couple of observations and a couple of applications. So I guess the question is, why is it important that we see an example of friendship in the first place? You know, what is the point of it? I mean, we saw some great things here, but is it important? And I believe it is, because very simple reason, Jesus has called us his friends, and in so doing, he has made his church friends with each other as well, and even to a deeper extent, we're brothers and sisters. But in the sense of seeing the nature of the relationship between Jonathan and David and what Christ asked for his church, there are a lot of similarities, because the same idea surrounds them both, that we are friends. So why is it important? Because we are friends. So I'll just touch briefly on what some of the, I guess, the benefits or some of the outworkings of this friendship in their life of Jonathan and David, and how that can apply to us. So firstly, it was a public demonstration of Christ's character. This relationship was a very public one. Jonathan made sure that everyone knew he was going to be second to David. David let everyone know that he had a covenant with him and he was going to remember him publicly by honouring his son. So it's a public demonstration. So we read before in that passage in Samuel, he said, yeah, even my father Saul knows this. You'll be king over Israel, I'll be second to you. He was making it public, the nature of their friendship. And Jesus kind of asked the same from us. He actually said the nature of our relationship is going to be a public demonstration of character as well. You might recall in John 13, He says, by this everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you love one another. So again, he uses an example of love as a public demonstration to those outside. It's an example of our relationship with Jesus. And in this case, the love between Jonathan and David was an example of their character as well. Secondly, we could see the benefit in adversity. And this was the real meat of the relationship between Jonathan and David, because they didn't know each other for long before things turned very sour between Saul and David, and their relationship was really birthed and formed in this adversity. Proverbs is a great verse in chapter 17. It says, a friend loves at all times, but a brother is born for adversity, and so good friends, and as we see here, are born for adversity. So we saw a few examples of that. Sometimes actually helped, like Jonathan actually prevented Saul's hand for a while there against David. Later on, he was encouraging him when he went to him in Horeb, and we read about that as well. He went and encouraged David during a really troubling time for him. And Proverbs says something similar. It says, it's two are better than one because they have a good return for their labour. Provided them falls, the one will lift up his companion. But woe to the one who falls when there is not another to lift him up. So there is a great role for friendship in holding each other through adversity. And particularly in relation to the church, sometimes we're tempting, I can't find people to agree with, I don't get on with people with the church, okay, let's just ditch the whole lot and just be with God. Yeah, but reality is we need each other. And that's part of the encouragement we see, that if you're going to get through adversity, then you can't be so independent, you're actually going to need the support of friends. And so we see a couple of examples where the church is urged to do that. Paul in Romans said, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. And in Hebrews, continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison. And he's talking about when there is adversity, be with these people. So friends are to help us through adversity. And finally, they're to encourage us in God. Proverbs chapter 27 says, as iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens another. And it's the same idea. Not only are friends to be with us with adversity, but they actually make us better people through it. They actually encourage us. And so we saw that when Jonathan went out to David and he said he encouraged him in the Lord. He reminded him of God's promises towards him and of his faithfulness as well in their covenant. And in the same way, the church encourages one another. We're told in Thessalonians, therefore encourage one another and build up one another. It's the same kind of ideas here, that what's the importance of friendship? It's a public demonstration to the rest of the world of our love and of our relationship with Jesus ultimately, that it helps us through adversity and there to encourage us in God. So we'll just ask the question then, how do we get the benefit of good friends? What are some of the things that they actually did that made the friendship good? Not just the outcome in terms of what ingredients, what do we do? Similarly to apply this to ourselves. So I think firstly, we do actually need to commit ourselves to good friends. And when I say commit ourselves to good friends, there's two elements. That one's you've got to get good friends in the first place. So you don't just be friends with any old person. In fact, there's a lot of warnings in Scripture about that. Proverbs 13 says, he who walks with wise men will be wise, but the companion of fools will suffer harm. And Paul is even more blunt in 1 Corinthians. He says, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. Some of us think, friends are great, let's just keep to ourselves a heap of friends. And so actually, no, the wrong ones are bad. And particularly, and I know this, when you're growing up in your environments like school, university, work, and so on, you've got a lot of people around you, it's natural to want to be within their friendship group. But if you do, this inevitably happens. And you see it time and time again, bad company corrupts good morals. You take yourself entirely into the wings of those around you without thinking about the character of the people that you're choosing to be friends, and they corrupt you. So Proverbs 12 says, the righteous choose their friends carefully, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. And so this is that little tidbit where I was telling you what impressed me about Rocio before we were going out. We had a long car journey after we went surfing with the family, and I was able to ask her a lot of questions, but she actually revealed to me, and she was only 17 at the time, I think. I've got to better get that right. And she was just telling me about her experience. She'd been at school, like a lot of them. She had a wide circle of friends. She was a relatively popular girl, and she'd realised the impact it was having on her. And before I met her, she had essentially terminated a lot of those relationships and instead become friends with a couple of relatively unpopular girls who were nonetheless girls who were Christians and good ones at that. And that impressed me heaps, right? Because when I saw that, I was like, okay, there's someone who's actually gone against the pull of what's going on around them and said, no, I'm going to make a very deliberate decision to choose good friends. So that impressed me very much about her. And I think that's when you look at Jonathan and David, you can see they certainly chose wisely. They were both men of the very same spirit. They were both inspired men of God. They were both bold and fearless. And thus, they were good friends for each other. So encouraging with this, that we make commitments to good friends, just make sure your friends are good friends. Right? And some of you may need to make some hard decisions at the moment around that as well. And go, actually, I've got friends who are fun, but they're not actually good for me. And then secondly, when you do find a good friend, you commit to them. Once Jonathan found David, he'd wasted absolutely no time, did he? And the first thing is, he loved him as himself and he made a covenant with him. And he reaffirmed that covenant, as we saw, probably about four times over the course of the relatively small story we've just read. So when we're serious about when we've met a good friend, we have to be serious about that relationship as well. It's not just, you actually commit yourselves to them. Okay. And this is what we saw with them. So we commit ourselves to good friends, and then there's a nature of that friendship that we need to look to. So one is that there's self-sacrificing love within that, and we saw that within Jonathan. He sacrificed his own position to basically see that David fulfilled his purpose in God, even though that purpose in God was ultimately very much against Jonathan. Right, he would end in death, relatively uninspiring, the end of a dynasty, would never see any greatness, but he loved David and it did not matter to him. It did not matter to him that he supported David, despite that. Proverbs 17 says this is what a friend does. A friend loves at all times. We just read that before. And so we see great examples in both cases of Jonathan and David of loving each other. And ultimately Jesus told us that this is the point of friendship. He says, greater love has no one than this, that one lay down his life for his friends, in John chapter 15. And then later in John 3:16, not the normal John 3:16, but 1 John 3:16, he says something similar. He said, we know love by this, that he laid down his life for us. That's Jesus died for us. Therefore, we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. So that tells you, who are our friends? They are our brethren. And the nature of the love is the same nature of love that Christ showed us, that he laid down his life for us, so we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. So the first character of it is that there's self-sacrificing love. The second thing is that it was intimate. It was an intimate relationship, right? And I don't mean that in the slightest bit sexually. This is entirely platonic, but you get an expression they were very deeply connected. There was a great friendship there. There's a lot of expressions around how deep that was. Like in the end of 1 Samuel, it says they kissed each other and wept together. They were emotional about separating each other. And there's a very similar example in the New Testament. Some of you might remember in Acts, Paul is leaving the church of Ephesus knowing he won't see them again. And they're really grieved. And a very similar thing happens. It says, and they began to weep aloud and embraced Paul and repeatedly kissed him, grieving especially over the word which he had spoken, that they would not see his face again. Now, we don't tend to kiss each other, even though there's a lot of examples of it in the Bible. You know, greet each other with a holy kiss, and you see these kind of examples. Go, what is it? Obviously, there are cultural expressions to this, you know, and we know that the Middle Eastern cultures tend to have this very overwhelming and very physical display of affection, albeit platonic ones. And so we can still take from that, what is the nature of an intimate relationship? It's one that moves you that deeply, you know. And part of being intimate is that it needs to be more than totally surface level. If you're going to have good friends and you're actually going to be a help for them in adversity or be able to encourage them, you actually got to know a little bit about them, which means you need to spend a little bit of time with them. And Hebrews talks a bit about this. You make sure you encourage each other day after day, he says. There's a regularity to that. And again, he warns, don't forsake assembling together and catching up with your brethren, but keep encouraging each other through that. So there's a nature that we're going to be really identify these friends and commit to them, that part of that is actually to do life with them and be involved enough with them that you can actually be of help to each other, you can be real friends to each other. And I know this, you know, in my own life especially, that if I'm not meeting up regularly with believers, there's a real impact on your spiritual walk. It's almost palpable. It happens really quickly. You know, I can go a week without seeing a Christian and suddenly I'm like, things are drying up a little. I just don't have that same energy and enthusiasm. So if you're going to have good friendships that it will help you with your spiritual walk and encourage you, just make sure that you're putting the time into them that they deserve. And there's a massive community that Jesus has built. The church is his idea. They would bring us together and give us that relationship that will build each other up and keep us going. And then finally, there's an element of truth that comes through in good friendships. And this is part of, you know, why you choose good friends, because your friends end up giving you counsel, and good counsel is sweet, Proverbs says, but it's got to be careful that we do have friends who are willing to tell us the truth even when it hurts. So remember David said, Jonathan, if I'm guilty, he says, then kill me yourself. Why hand me over to your father? When he was asking, he had a good enough relationship with Jonathan, knowing that Jonathan would tell him the truth. If I'm guilty, tell me. And he trusted him enough. He said that you can kill me if you think I'm guilty. That's fine. So he trusted him. So they had that level of relationship. Proverbs tells us that faithful are the wounds of a friend. So a good friend is at times going to tell you the truth and it's going to hurt. Faithful are the wounds of a friend. And this is where it's be careful. It's easy to heap yourself friends around you who will tickle your ears, who will encourage you in your every folly. That's not the point, to be encouraged in folly. It's actually be encouraged in truth and in God. So take on friends who, even though they may not always say nice things, will always say the truth. And again, there's more we could say about that, but I'm actually going to leave that, because in a couple of weeks we actually have a bit more on that topic with Andrew Glover speaking, so I'll leave that there. But this basic idea that we speak the truth in love. You know, a lot of us say, oh, it's just all about the love, nice words, but it's actually the truth in love. So that the truth is the central point that we need to be able to speak to each other and be confident in doing so. So those are the attributes. I could end there, but I can't end without just showing how Christ is the ultimate friend, amen? He's just amazing. If I pop back through these quickly, you can just see that there, you know, Christ made us friends publicly. He was publicly beaten for us. He publicly died for us. He encourages us in our every weakness. He suffered every temptation like we do. So he's able to encourage us in adversity. And through relationship with him, he actually transforms us. So not only encourages us, God, but he actually shows us how to be like him directly. And through gazing upon him, we're told we are transformed into his image. And finally, in how he committed to us, he made a covenant. It's a new covenant, and he purchased and sealed that covenant with his own blood. And that same blood is the evidence of his love toward us, because he ultimately laid down his life for his friend, as he asked us to do. He was the ultimate demonstration. He wants to be intimate with us. He wants us to dine with him, it says in Revelation. So he values and desires a great and intimate relationship with him. And finally, he's given us the Holy Spirit who leads us into all truth. So he is the ultimate example of friendship. I'm going to invite the music team up. We're going to sing a song, and you can see a few thoughts in there that just really talk about this idea. What a friend we have in Jesus. So let's all be standing as we sing that song together.